Cinema is the world's greatest fraud. After politics, anyway. This is Cinema Bill. Today, we're continuing the Wonders in the Dark science fiction countdown with number 76, the modern anime classic Paprika, the last film directed by the late Satoshi Kon. Checkerfill and I will discuss the film on a number of fronts, but first, seeing as we're doing a science fiction countdown, we might as well discuss a certain impending post-apocalyptic dystopia that's rapidly approaching. You might know it as the U.S. presidential election. Now, you might be tempted to look at the epic build-up and sustained insanity of the 2016 presidential race as the kind of opportunity a documentarian might dream about at their most feverishly decadent. If it weren't for 24-hour news channels and online media outlets draining every drop of milk from the udder before a feature-length filmmaker has the time to even collect daily rushes, you might even be able to expect a classic on the order of The War Room being released about a year after inauguration, only with less ties to agreed-upon reality and the kind of freewheeling absurdism you might get if Fellini managed to direct something halfway coherent out of a Philip K. Dick novel. On one side of the aisle, you've had one foregone conclusion of obvious, qualified candidates getting picked off after another. Nobody in their wildest nightmares ever would have imagined that Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Ted Cruz, and even Marco Rubio ever would have fallen to the likes of Donald Trump. Rand Paul, at least, you could have betted would drop out without much effort, but only because he'd be following in his father's footsteps. And on the other side, you've had one foregone conclusion wind up coming true after all, but only after the electorate had been dragged kicking and screaming into submission. Hillary Clinton has, at long last, gotten her prophesied coronation as nominee of the Democratic Party. But it took a brutal war with Bernie Sanders and supporters, the likes of which would make the Red Wedding look like an episode of Say Yes to the Dress, to actually get there. And along the way, we've seen the process interrupted, assisted, and otherwise perverted by as strange an assortment of electoral sideshows as only our greatest satirists could have possibly recognized on the horizon. We've seen whiffs of the Zodiac killings, the JFK assassination, and Russian hackers sending love notes to WikiLeaks. We've had candidates played on Saturday Night Live by the creator of Seinfeld and by a female Ghostbuster. We've had birds from a Disney princess movie landing on microphone podiums, and we've had somebody actually bothering to wear a white pantsuit before Labor Day. And this isn't even mentioning the sheer insanity being spouted off by the ultimate Republican nominee, who seemed fit to comment on everything from journalists' menstruation cycles to the joyful prospect of mob violence in the middle of his own rallies, with the level of maturity and sophistication that you might find from Cartman on South Park. It's an election season where you can barely even bother to look at political cartoons, simply for the fact that nothing could possibly compare with how strange things already are without the assistance of pen and ink. This is all to say that I'm looking forward to casting my ballot for Hillary in November, if for no other reason than so things can go back to being normal. Dare I say, even boring. As boring as the vice president she picked, about whom the best thing can be said is that he has a winning resemblance to any number of Liza Minnelli's husbands. At least when he smiles, anyway. I'm looking forward to voting for a nominee who might not have the most exciting platform in presidential history. I'd like to believe that she'll be half as progressive as her acceptance speech would suggest, but considering her delivery, as always, was just shy of a failing score on a Voight-Kampff test, I'm hedging any bets my optimism might want to place. I'm looking forward because at the end of the day, it'll mean a return to sanity. A return to a political landscape that isn't caught in the constant state of sweeps-weak sensationalism. I'm looking forward to a president who, like the one before, will make history simply by taking the oath of office, and has every bit the level of skill and experience needed to lead a nation through some of its most sustained and ingrained hardships. And even if she isn't likely to make good on every promise or every opportunity for progressive change along the way, I look forward to Hillary as president because I'm unable to see anything past inauguration should Trump win. Not because he's too unpredictable to come up with any foreseeable outcome, though considering his record, he might be, but rather because the very idea of a Trump presidency feels so dangerous, so irresponsible, that it feels apocalyptic to the very fabric of the Republic all on its own. You can't see into the future past the end of the world. Ultimately, that's why I'm voting for Hillary. I might not see the best possible outcome with her in the White House, but the fact that I can see an outcome at all is better than nothing. Literally. Better than nothing. Better than a void. Better than the horrors of a black hole so massive and bloated that even Maximilian Schell wouldn't go near it. And sure, I might feel a certain temptation to vote for a Jill Stein with all the other Bernie bros and stick it to the man, who just happens to be a woman this time. But to do so would risk repeating the same mistakes made during another such fateful election back in 1999. And yes, I got the date right. Everybody else might be comparing 2016 to the year 2000, when Nader voters helped doom the country to the president with the furthest intellectual distance from Mensa in history. But to my eyes, the prospect of liberals deserting Hillary and allowing Trump to ascend resembles nothing else but the vote of no confidence that helped Palpatine win his election in The Phantom Menace, paving the way for him to Patriot Act his way into declaring the First Galactic Empire. Make no mistake, Trump won't be another Bush. We should be so lucky. This is how liberty dies, people, with thunderous applause. And with that out of the way, let's move on to happier subjects. Nightmares, delusions, and the inevitability of death! Checkerville and I recorded this conversation after viewing Paprika separately, but according to the theories of shared dreaming the movie endorses, who's to say it was so separate after all? Okay, so this is the only Satoshi Kon movie you've seen, right?
Yes, it's true. The only Satoshi Kon movie I've ever seen. No Tokyo Godfathers, no none of that. Don't know nothing.
Okay, the only other thing of his I've seen is Perfect Blue, which is really good. I've seen little bits and pieces of Tokyo Godfathers, but I've been sort of like, you know, Tokyo Godfathers is an interesting movie because it's an anime remake of the John Ford movie Three Godfathers.
Really?
Yeah. It's a remake of a movie set out in the West where, like, three cowboys find this, you know, orphaned baby, and they decide to try and bring it to civilization or something.
Oh, didn't they do Three Men and a Baby doing the same sort of plot?
There was also a French movie that Three Men and a Baby was based on. So this idea of three unlikely guys taking care of a baby it seems to be remade a whole lot. It's, like, remade over and over again. And here it is, you have, like, the anime version of it where you have homeless guys, transgender person and everything, and, like, a homeless teenage girl all taking care of this little baby.
Well, that actually sounds more interesting than watching three cowboys do it.
I'm not really a big fan of most John Ford movies in general, but
they always seem to have really good remake opportunities. Like you know, like
Didn't he do True Grit?
No, I don't think he did do True Grit. I know that John Wayne was in True Grit, but I don't know if he is the one, if John Ford is the one who directed it. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, I don't know. But, like, some of the movies that John Ford directed are, like, you know, he did Stagecoach, which is very famous.
Mm-hmm.
He did, like, Young Mr. Lincoln. The big one that's really famous for a lot of film people is he did The Searchers, which is all about, like,
cowboys. Wasn't it Marilyn Monroe in that one?
Natalie Wood.
Ah, okay.
And The Searchers is a movie that's really famous and beloved by, like, film buffs. And it's one of those movies that I think every film that's been made inspired by The Searchers, I think, is better than The Searchers. Taxi Driver is better than The Searchers. The Star Wars shout-outs to The Searchers in, like, you know, the original Star Wars or Attack of the Clones, where Anakin's going to, like, save his mother after being kidnapped by the Sand People, that's better than The Searchers.
Mm-hmm.
There was recently a French movie that's sort of retelling the basic story beats of The Searchers in the modern world, and which is very interesting. But
he's famous for The Grapes of Wrath.
Oh yeah, The Grapes of Wrath.
1940.
The Grapes of Wrath, and also How Green Was My Valley. That is famous for beating Citizen Kane at all the Oscars.
You got 4 Oscars.
Yeah. So if anybody's interested in seeing the weirdest possible remake of a John Ford Western that you can possibly imagine, Tokyo Godfathers is probably it. And, you know, even just like from the short glimpses of it that I've seen, it's absolutely worth seeing.
Well, you got my vote. I want to check it out.
Yeah, but I mean, like, Satoshi Kon is one of those guys who, because we only have, like, you know, say 10 or 15 years worth of his work available to us as a director, it's always going to sort of, like, torture us imagining what might have been. Because, you know, he passed away, like, a few years after he did Paprika. And Paprika was, like, his first big, wide, international hit.
And like, wasn't this his, like, he had just finished it and then he died, right?
He didn't just finish it, actually. He got pretty deep into production on another movie that people, I think, are still trying to make. Like, The Dream Machine, I think it's called.
Uh-huh.
It's all about, like, robots or toys or something like that. And it looks really amazing, but there's a very good chance it's not going to get made because they just don't have the money now to do it after him passing away.
That sucks.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the stuff that we have of his to look at now and to see the breadth of his career, we have the movies that he directed, obviously, Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress, Tokyo Godfathers, and Paprika.
Paprika.
We have the anime series that he directed for TV, Paranoia Agent, which was a really fantastic show, but also is, like, fallen into the memory hole that happens when you no longer have, like, viable DVD releases of stuff. Like, if you want to see Paranoia Agent right now, you sort of have to resort to watching it online or trying
You can grab that on Crunchyroll or any of the other ones.
I'm not sure if you can watch it on Crunchyroll. I should check that. But, like, it's easier to find, like, a British import DVD of it in, like, Region 2.
Mm.
But when you do that, you're not getting the full Paranoia Agent experience because they cut scenes out.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. The other thing that's happened in the past couple years is there are, like, Dark Horse and some other companies have released a lot of his old manga.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, and, like, if you... Right, and so for anybody who wants to, like, really read Satoshi Kon's manga, and that's really where he started, you have to remember. He started as a manga assistant to Katsuhiro Otomo on Akira.
All right.
And, you know, remember, on the way that, you know, mangas are done, an assistant can be doing a whole lot of the heavy lifting on a manga. You know, they could be doing all of the backgrounds, they could be doing all of the inking and stuff, so
yeah.
There's a lot of Satoshi Kon in, like, the Akira manga and some other things, but if you really want to see a great example of his work that is, like, the next best thing to, like, a fifth Satoshi Kon movie, check out the manga Opus. It's all about a Japanese cartoonist, a mangaka, who's finishing this long-running popular manga that he's been doing. He intends to kill off the major character, but the major character gets wind of this and escapes from the manga world to steal the last pages and drags the creator down into the rabbit hole of the manga world, and it just gets crazier and more surreal and metatextual from there. Especially, you know, it's really sad looking at how he was one of the, like, and you can see this right there in Paprika, he was one of the few people working today who was doing this type of surrealism and this type of metatextuality and making it fun. He was making it fun in a way that I think even a guy like Charlie Kaufman doesn't do quite as much, in like being John Malkovich or Anomalisa. You know, a movie like Paprika is absolutely playing with the form and playing with the medium and your expectations with it just as much as being John Malkovich or Synecdoche, New York.
Right.
But it's also an incredibly fun adventure movie.
But it also expects you to be smart and understand, like, certain concepts, like film in general. Like, you got to know, like, A Fair to Remember. You got to know, like, Tarzan. You got to know all these different films that they're referring to. Or maybe not.
Right. I mean, he tries to...
You get the idea.
Right. Like, he makes it sort of easy. Like, the film shout-outs that you have in this movie are not terribly obscure. Like, the biggest film shout-out, I think, in this movie is between Tarzan and some other stuff. Like, you have, you know, From Russia with Love, the train scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, like, one of the big film shout-outs there. And that's very easy to pick up on. But, I mean, like, beyond that, you have, like, it's what's more interesting, or, I mean, like, what's more important in this movie than, like, the individual film shout-outs or what he knows and demonstrates about just, like, filmmaking in general. Like, the whole scene where somebody, like, inside his dream is describing the action line and not breaking the 180-degree rule.
Right. He's talking about, like, directing film. Like, he's wearing the little hat and the glasses, the sunglasses, and he's talking to Paprika.
Right. Yeah, and when he's wearing that little hat, you know whose little hat that is?
Whose?
Kurosawa.
Ah, so he's imitating Kurosawa at that point.
Yeah, I think it's Kurosawa anyway. Uh-huh. But yeah, I mean, like, that whole thing there, he's giving you a little mini filmmaking lesson right there in terms of don't cross this line or you'll wind up on the other end of the screen and you shouldn't do that.
Right, and luckily it's coming from this point of a kind of this student filmmaker, which the story ends up leaning towards. Spoiler alert! I'm just letting you know. Spoiler alert! If anybody that's listening to this right now, you really have to see this movie. Okay, I'm just saying.
Yeah, but what's also great about that is that you can tell it's coming from a very personal place of like his own past as like a young filmmaker growing up, and this is the sort of thing that you learn and understand, and you're willing to pass on to somebody.
Yes.
But I mean, like. What's some of the other things here?
All right.
The way that he uses film is not just in terms of letting you look at this as a piece of film that is aware of itself as film. This is also using films as a metaphor of understanding the way that dreams work.
Right. And so,
it's very clever early on the way he says that, like, you know, early dreams in your sleep cycle are more like experimental shorts, and the later ones are more like fully formed features.
Ah, yes.
I don't know if that's entirely accurate as to how REM cycle works, but it's a really good way of approximating and letting you wrap your mind around
that. Well, it's going from this book, and it's also going with its own form of science, an own form of everything, this whole world of the DC Mini, and all these things, this super science that they're talking about, like, in graphic detail, like, these ideas on how these things work. It's like, they're putting this all together. So, in their world, yeah, these things work. And also, film and things like that as a form of travel.
Yeah.
You travel your spirit, travel your dreams, travel literally.
Yeah.
Paprika travels through, uses film and pictures to be able to travel from place to place to place.
It's an interesting one. She uses film on the level of, like, being on the outsider and looking in when she's, like, showing the, like, you know, the detective, his dreams later on, I thought it was a little, you know, at times a little too neat how what we see as the audience matches up perfectly to what's on her screen being shown as his dream. It doesn't look like she's showing him a dream. It looks like she's showing him, like, Avid footage while she's editing a feature based on his dream. But at the same time, again, it is using the filmmaking as metaphor for what we do every night when we dream. So that works out perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I thought was really interesting is that whenever she does, you know, dive into his dreams or dive into anybody's dreams, they're largely using the filmic images to provide some sort of basis. Like, you know, she'll go into somebody's dreams and she'll transform into Tinkerbell. She'll transform into Pinocchio.
To things that are familiar to people and familiar to dreamers and things like
that. And that's also, I mean, like...
Yeah, also, like, she's Pinocchio, like, is she, like, a real girl? Is she truly real?
Mm.
Is she?
Like, or the fairy and everything. Yeah,
exactly.
The spectral.
And she is like a fairy to them. She's able to go there and help and be of service to these people.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's very interesting how he uses all of those recognizable images as sort of landmarks to keep you guided while you're going through all these different dreams.
Now, film touchstones, if you will.
Yeah, especially for all the different ways that he, like, begins to morph images together and blend them together. Like, this is not the most heavily animated feature in the world at certain points. There's a lot of very still moments, which you have in a lot of Japanese animation. But when you have the heavy animation, it tends to be when, you know, faces are morphing into one another and there you have, like, a little bit of that body horror going on.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that he makes that work in animation better than other people necessarily is because he's using those recognizable images, those landmarks, so that it's easier for you to accept seeing somebody's face morphing in and out of, like, a doll's face, because you look at that and think, ah, that's a doll's face, it's porcelain, I kind of know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
Then to see somebody's face morph into it, it becomes really kind of disturbing.
Yeah, very, very, very creepy when they do stuff like that, and I love... But what I'd like to talk about is their use of... You were talking about scenes being very still and not, like, not going super surrealistic, but then there are parts where they just keep it very normal. I remember there's the scene where the woman, not Paprika, but the kind of the host for Paprika.
Right. I mean,
she yells at the guy.
Right,
she's
the,
like,
alter ego.
Yeah,
the
alter
Clark
ego.
Kent.
And she's just like, you know, you act like a child, you're a big slob, and, you know, and just yells at him and, like, leaves.
Right.
And then it goes to the shot of the guy.
Right, like,
and
this high shot.
Yeah, and from above, and he's just, like, defeated at that time, because this woman, and he's just, like, yelled at him, and it just keeps on him.
Yeah.
The shot keeps on him, and I'm like, really? Are we going to go with the shot? And they hold that shot for a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's great here that you have, that you don't necessarily have in a lot of Western animation, where the premium is always having a lot of motion, even for the very still moments.
Yeah, a lot of action out, camera angles and
lens
flare. Not, you know.
Well, I'm just talking about animation in general.
Okay.
Like if you look at, say, compare the moments in an anime movie like this or other animated movies from Japan with, say, the animation that you might have on a movie from the same from Disney from the same era of, like, the 101 Dalmatians. Specifically, look at the pencil tests that you have for a scene in 101 Dalmatians where the lead dog owner, the lead songwriting guy in the movie.
Right.
There's a scene in the movie where he is smoking his pipe. And he looks at his watch.
Right.
Two little actions, like he does like a little stretch, but he's really only has like two or three actions that he's performing in the scene. In an anime movie, you would probably have those actions performed.
Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay.
I don't know why it's doing that.
Okay,
sorry,
I'm
trying to make it be mute.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay, I'm gonna have to start again here.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay,
I'll just not go for it.
Okay. Now in this scene in 101 Dalmatians, like the lead, this guy, he's smoking his pipe, he's looking at his watch, and he's stretching a little bit. That's three major actions in the scene. In an anime movie, you would probably have those actions done by, like, three or four key frames or something, and maybe the whole thing would be filled out by, I don't want to estimate exactly how many frames that you'd need, but, like, you could get that done with, I think that you could very easily get that done on some level with 12 to 30 drawings holding on a lot of frames, holding the same image for a long while. In 101 Dalmatians, and if you look at the pencil test, you can see exactly how many drawings they go through. I think you get near 100 drawings, or past 100 drawings, for these three actions. You know, looking at your watch, smoking your pipe, and stretching. So, and it's not to say that one is inherently better than the other. If you look at that scene in, 101 Dalmatians, it looks really cool and beautiful to see exactly how fluid and natural it looks for this guy to be doing all these everyday, ordinary things. And it's really nice to have that type of animation put into, just the sheer mundane little moments in life. But at the same time, I also really like seeing in an animated, an anime feature or a TV show, how much they can get out of fewer drawings. And I especially really love the moments in anime where you can have a huge impact and a huge moment occurring from two or three drawings, or just one drawing and holding on that for a while. So there's something to that, to be said here for that moment in Paprika where we just hold on that one drawing of Dr. Takeda,
mm-hmm.
Hurt and looking away and just not really reacting. There's a lot of moments in this movie where you can see they're holding the same drawing or they're using the same loop over and over again, like, say, when she's pulling him out of the elevator.
Right.
You can see the same two frames are being used again and again until they finally fall out.
Gets him out, right.
There is a very neat economy of the animation resources being used in this movie and a lot of other anime films, because what they're doing is they're saving on some moments and then using the rest of their resources to have as big an impact later on, like
any parade scene.
Right, any parade scene, especially towards the end, they are spending every dollar they can, every yen
right.
they can.
I mean, seriously, they're doing every single movement of all these different things, all moving, and, like, confetti, seriously, and wind blowing, for
right.
real?
Yeah, and the sheer volume of different designs that you have, the sheer volume of different things that are morphing into different things.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many things that are going on here. And the sheer scale of what's going on, too. This is something that happens throughout the movie. You have, most of the movie is shot or animated at very long shots, very wide-angle shots. This is something that I noticed in the movie. Where a lot of other movies, both live-action and animated, and where even, a lot of other anime movies would sit on, say, a close-up of a character and make them look a little bit more angular or graphically interesting to, make something interesting in the frame. What Satoshi Kon does is he has a very, very wide angle. Like, he won't just... He isn't just happy on letting us see Dr. Chiba in a hallway. He has to pull it back just wide enough so that we can see Dr. Chiba, the hallway, and a window out of which we can see the distant background way out there,
right.
too.
And you're just showing off at that point. Come on, man. That's beautiful. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, but what it also does is that at every step of the way, it reminds you where they're rooted in the real world.
Mm.
And that's very purposeful and very necessary in a movie like this where much of the time you could be wondering how much of what I'm seeing is real and how much isn't real. How much of what we're seeing is reliably showing us what's actually happening. And I think there are some moments in the movie where it gets a little loose,
mm-hmm.
where they're playing certain things for laughs and you wonder, is this really happening? Like, you know, Dr. Takeda in the movie, that scene where he's in the restaurant. And
right,
he's ordering,
I had a feeling you were going to say that.
Yeah, where he's ordering three huge entrees at once. Yes, they are making a joke at, you know, how fat he is and how much he's overeating, but at the same time, at the same time, I can't watch that scene and not think to myself, there's a little bit of dream logic going on even now, so you can't quite be sure if what you're seeing is real.
Well, I'd like to state this point, that I think what they're showing is that how Tokita is able, is really suffering. He's really suffering, like, part of his thing is that he has to keep eating. He says, I have to eat, it helps me think, or, like, all these things. It's part of this logic, this kind of this sick logic that a compulsive overeater would have to like, he's equating his thinking process with eating, so he has to keep eating to, he probably thinks he's fueling these things. And that's what I think one of the things about this movie. This movie is about literally being stuck in dreams, stuck in your life, stuck in your life.
Yeah, everybody in this movie, in some shape or form, is caught in some harmful habit.
Yeah, some loop, like the cop with the
situation. Right, like the cop is caught in this dream that he keeps having that's tied to his past and his guilt over what happened with his friend.
Mm-hmm.
The chairman is, of course, stuck in his physical impairment.
Right.
And he's stuck in this insane plan that he has to reshape the world into something utterly bizarre.
And his lackey is...
His
love for the
Dr.
woman.
Dr.
Chiba.
And even Dr. Chiba herself. What's interesting about this movie is that because you have Dr. Chiba and Paprika as two sides of the same coin...
Mm-hmm.
One, this fits very comfortably into, like, the very familiar sort of superhero dynamic of the, you know, secret identity.
Right, you called her Clark Kent before. But
right,
yeah,
like, the secret identity and the alter ego. You know, like, you have Dr. Chiba, who's very, very straight-laced, very, very repressed. And then you have Paprika, who's, like, the most... I mean, she's, like, a personification of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Right.
Only... She's somebody who is self-empowered, who does her own thing.
And it's funny that that Chiba's the one that gets to do the nude scene. Funny.
Yeah, well, funny, and also, I mean, that whole scene in general, we can talk about it in a little bit.
Sure.
But, like, the fact that you have Paprika as this Manic Pixie Dream Girl type character, I don't know how aware people in Japan were of that type in American movies at the time. But there certainly was a presence for characters like that in anime. Like, you know, you could call it the magical girl thing.
Yeah, sure, magical
girl. Or you could call it, like, you know, the sexualized character who's there to help empower the main character in an anime, like Asuka or something. But what's interesting here is that you have somebody who basically has no personal entanglements of any kind, obviously, because she's just an alter ego.
Yeah, they just want to help.
Right. But it's interesting that she's there primarily for the empowerment of Dr. Chiba, for her, you know, for herself.
Kind of like the genie in Aladdin or something like that.
Right. She's a version of the genie that is there. Right. She's like the genie, the Tyler Durden, who's there to empower the main character.
Mm-hmm. And she literally is the Tyler Durden.
Right, but it's interesting having a character like that who's there to help support a female character rather than the Manic Pixie Dream Girl who's there to be the fetish object for, you know, some nebbishy guy.
But she is a fetish object for everybody.
Yeah,
it's like, are there any other really other women in that film at all?
True, and she... Well, and she
and everybody's attracted to them.
Right.
Everybody.
Right. She is a fetish object in that sense, but she's always an unattainable one. She is not the, you know, she is not...
And she'll tell you to your face.
Right. Mm-hmm. She is not the dream girl who is there only to improve the life of a male character and, you know, help him succeed in the end. She is there to help people, but keep distance, keep walls, and she's there primarily at the end to help Dr. Chiba be the one who saves the day. And it's important that at the end, she saves, you know, she beats the chairman in her Chiba form.
Right, right. So yeah, she has to do it on
And I'm getting her name right, right?
Yes, Dr. Chiba.
Okay, good. But,
Well, you were talking about that end scene over there with that final fight versus
right.
the chairman.
No.
I would like to say something about the chairman. Dude, what's up with the tentacles? Can we go for even more of a stereotypical anime sort of thing?
Well, here's the thing that I like about the tentacles here.
Yeah.
They are not tentacles as we usually see them. They are not tentacles as, like, you know, the octopus thing. They are not Cthulhu tentacles.
Okay.
They are vines.
Yeah, you know what? I saw that in Evil Dead. What are you talking about?
Let's be honest. In Evil Dead, it's very unrefined. We're just seeing, like, you know, the cheapest special effects that we can get. Here, we really feel the living and breathing aspects of these vines and these, you know, tree parts that are coming to life.
Mm-hmm.
It feels way more real than you could have gotten on, like, a B-movie like Evil Dead back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, you know, the fact that we have these tentacles that are, like, arboreal in nature, because we have the tree-vine sort of things, it's good because it does fit into that pattern of the tentacles in Japanese fetish stuff.
Sure.
And they do play with that some.
They do. Like,
you know,
he's
with,
trying,
like,
to get her. And
right, he's trying,
like,
to get her.
And she's trying to fly
her
away.
And right.
The little panty shot in there.
Well, right. But it's also, like, when he grabs her and he's going to try and crush her in, like, the butterfly room.
Yeah.
And you see, like, you know, they definitely accentuate the phallic stuff there by, like, shoving vines down her mouth.
Right, right.
But at the same time, it's good to have something that is a little different from, you know, I don't know, what you might have seen, like, in really bad hentai, like, Orotsuka Doji.
Yeah, whatever. I knew it. Everybody brings it back to that one.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, that shit. But it's nice to have something that references that,
uh-huh.
but does it in a different way. And the fact that he is taking on the plant form, the fact that he is taking on a vegetative form, that is another symbol of being stuck. He is not somebody who, you know, the chairman is not somebody who aspires to a living, breathing, animal monstrous image.
Mm-hmm.
His great aspiration is that him as that giant tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically, you know, it's interesting because that's an image of life, but it's also an image of stasis.
And stagnation, right. Trees don't necessarily go anyplace or do anything unless
yeah.
they're like Ents or something like that. I mean, they just basically stay put.
Yeah, and there's a little bit, like, I wonder if there's, like, there's a little bit of a hint of that sort of thing in, like, other Japanese things. Like, I remember seeing the tree with the big face on it, and, you know, when I first saw this movie and thinking of, like, Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, the first dungeon there is you're going inside this tree that has a great big face on it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is showing a monstrous version of that. This is showing the chairman as this ancient, immovable thing. So there's something really interesting to that, using that thing and using these great animation resources to give you a character who is vivid and at the same time completely static in the way that he is, and it gives you a good on-screen demonstration of what his philosophy is.
Mm. Now, I would like to say that he did not create this in a vacuum. It took like a whole team to make this happen. So, and also the writer was in on this, right? And the director and the music. I would like to definitely give a shout out to, what is it, Susumu that soundtrack is something.
It's a very different sound that you would have for a lot of movies, especially because, like, in anime, we tend to be used to hearing the same type of music over and over again.
Sure.
Like, if you watch Miyazaki movies, you're going to hear Joe Hisaishi
mm-hmm.
over and over again. If you hear, like, you know, like, other people who are very commonly used are,
we do the same sort of thing, but this was like...
No, but I mean, like, there are other people who tend to pop up again and again. Like, the guy who did the music for Evangelion also did a lot of music for other Gainax things, so you have that very familiar sound, such to the point that, like, when they've done the new Evangelion movies, the Rebuild movies, they wound up recycling a lot of music that he did for other Gainax shows. Like, when they did Evangelion 2.0, they reused a lot of Kare Kano music. His and Her Circumstances.
Oh,
and
when I love the theme song of that show.
Right. And then when they did Evangelion 3.0, they reused music from Nadia, The Secret of Blue Water.
Really?
Right. And it fits both as a reference to what's going on in, like, those scenes, because, like, they're using the music of, like, the liftoff of the Nautilus spaceship in from Nadia, and they're using it in Evangelion for the liftoff of a new Evangelion-style spaceship. So it fits as a kind of reference, but at the same time, you're recycling stuff, and the reason why you're getting away with recycling music is you're using the same composer, and you can get away with it.
And the same sort of ideas. Here's a liftoff, here's a liftoff. Here's a thing, here's a thing.
Right, and same thing is true of the Katakano music, too, mm-hmm. because that, you know, in 2.0, you're having a lot more of the slice of life, high school comedy sort of thing going on. But I mean, like, even, like, what's the name of the person who did the music for Cowboy Bebop?
Oh, I could look it up, but, you know, we could insert it.
Yeah. Because I think the person who did the music for Cowboy Bebop is Yoko Kanno.
You sure?
I'm pretty sure it's Yoko Kanno.
Okay, let me put a thing on it. Stick a pin on it.
Yeah, and see what other music they've done.
Who did the music for Cowboy Bebop?
Cowboy Bebop's music was composed by Yoko Kanno.
Okay.
Okay, now see what else Yoko Kanno did.
All right.
See if... Is that a he or a she?
She.
Okay, see if she did the music for Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex.
All right, so... Yoko Kanno.
Here's some information about Yoko Kanno.
All right, here's what she did. Mm-hmm. Macross. Let's see. Wikipedia. Well, Wikipedia her. She did films, video games. Wow, she looks cool. That's her in 1999. She's 52 now.
Hmm.
Okay, so let's see. Here's what we got. I think you're gonna be happy with this. She did Cowboy Bebop, Darker Than Black, Macross Plus, A Gundam, Turn a Gundam, A Vision of Escaflowne,
mm-hmm.
Ghost in the Shell, Standalone Complex, Wolf's Rain, Kids on the Slope,
Danko
no Terror.
Yeah, there you go. What's interesting there is that obviously you have a composer like Yoko Kanno or Joe Hisashi or the Evangelion composer. They tend to work with the same directors and the same people over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, look at David Lynch and the posse he uses.
Yeah, and Badalamenti.
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, like, in anime, this tends to be magnified because you only see certain directors and their work exported over to the United States or Europe in a real heavy way. So you get to see a lot of Miyazaki, a lot of, you know, Hideki Anno or Shinichiro Watanabe, but you don't see a whole lot of anything else. So when we hear the soundtracks to these things, after a while they can have a bit of a uniform sound, especially if a composer like a Yoko Kanno works with the same people and other people over and over again, and their work gets exported. But the fact that, like, Paprika has a very different kind of sound.
Yeah. Hirasana-san.
Yeah.
Give him props.
Yeah, I mean, the sound here, it was interesting. It was a blend between sort of J-pop at some moments and, like, a J-pop approximation of, like, adventure thriller music.
Well, also, it kind of reminded... Yeah, because they were doing all these different genres. Like, okay, here's the circus one. We have circus music. Here's the adventure one. We need adventure music. Here's the chase scene. We need chase music.
Yeah, and we get to hear a lot of these things over and over again. Like,
mm-hmm.
We get to hear the theme song a few times.
Uh-huh.
We get to hear...
In different forms. In different slower forms.
Right, we get to hear the parade music a lot.
Yep.
And then, you know, we do hear a lot of that adventure chase music stuff, so we definitely get a chance to be familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. It's a running theme.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's still going to be pretty alien compared to what we have in a lot of other anime.
For sure.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting about Paprika in general, besides how, you know, Satoshi Kon uses the animation and the design and the composition of everything, all of which make it, like, one of the best sci-fi movies there are out there.
You know what? I'll definitely say amen to that, my brother.
Yeah. The other thing that's really interesting about it is the way he treats dreams. And we've talked about this a little bit with how he equates dreams to film
mm-hmm.
and film technique. But even without that, he's going into a little bit of the science of how dreams work as a way of justifying the things he's doing in his story, the way he's directing it. You know, early on in the movie, he has Paprika say, you know, early dreams are, you know, short and they're experimental, sort of, and what later dreams are more like longer features. He is sort of getting us ready for the idea that the early dreams that you see in this movie are going to be very strange, but then as it goes on, we're going to have more of a beginning, middle, and end to things. So he's giving us, within the movie itself, an approximation of its idea of how dreams work. We're getting early REM stage dreams, later REM stage dreams.
So you think he's done a lot of research on sleep itself?
Possibly. At the very least, the person who he's adapting from has certainly done a lot of that.
Mm.
And this is something that I think is useful to look at in comparison to other movies that do dreams.
Dream movies.
Yeah, other movies that are specifically about, like, shared dreams,
right,
and about, you know, like, connecting with dreams.
We definitely brought up Inception.
Yeah,
2010,
and, yeah.
Inception.
And what's interesting here is that everything that Inception gets right about how to use dreams and treat dreams,
mm-hmm,
Inception gets completely wrong.
Hold it, Inception or Paprika?
Inception gets that stuff wrong. Paprika gets everything right.
Okay, well, I'll give him props on that.
Yeah,
okay,
I mean, like,
how so? Explain.
Okay, Paprika, the whole, every step of the way in Paprika, the dreams are surreal, but purposefully so. Especially in, you know, the transitions that we get in Paprika from one dream to the next are associative in nature, and they feel very right for the types of experiences that you might have in dream. Where, like, say, in a dream, you might look at, you know, an advert, you might see, like, a little toy Pinocchio lying somewhere, and then the next moment, you are Pinocchio, without you're even realizing it. This is something that we get right away at the beginning of the movie, where, you know, like, during the circus moment,
yeah,
you are, you know, the cop is simultaneously on stage in the cage and up pointing at himself.
Right.
And he doesn't know how that happened. All the transitions in the movie are very much like that, and what's cool is that we get that introduced to us here at the beginning of the movie, then later on we get to see Paprika use that as a skill. She knows how to navigate the associative nature of dreams.
Right, that's like a person that has a lucid dreaming.
She's
been doing it for so long,
right,
she's perfected lucid dreaming.
Right, you know, she is able to go from, you know, Tinkerbell flying into a painting in a dream, becoming one with the painting, where she's, like, you know, doing the Sphinx and Oedipus thing for a little
right.
bit. Then she's hit, falls down into the water. As soon as she falls down into the water, what does she do?
She becomes a mermaid.
And then when she's the mermaid, you know, the guy turns into a whale and swallows her up. What does she do to get out of that?
What did she do?
She turns into Pinocchio.
Right.
So she...
because Pinocchio, yeah, and then
right,
the whale
so
thing.
She,
right,
so she is using the associative nature and dream of dreams, and she's using...
Very Freudian.
And she's using the pop culture contents of her own mind in order to navigate these dreams. This is really great, and it's also not a bad little implicit lesson on how to try and do lucid dreaming yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've practiced lucid dreaming,
yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah. Would you say that this is capturing some of the feeling of lucid dreaming?
For sure. Well, on her part, for sure. It's like knowing that you're dreaming. Once you know that you're dreaming, that's half the battle won.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that you've seen in those movies like Inception or Dreamscape.
Right.
Which,
well,
from 1984, I wanted to throw that one in there.
Right. Well, the thing is, like, a movie like Inception, I think, does not really capture the feeling of dreaming or the feeling of lucid dreaming, especially. Mm-hmm. Their hands seem so tied in Inception. They don't really do a whole lot of anything, and they definitely don't have the associative nature in Inception.
Mm-hmm.
In Inception...
They paid so much for the scenes, like, you just can't break from one scene to another like you can in animation.
Right, you can't necessarily do that, but, you know, think about it. There are definitely people who have figured out how to do associative dream logic in live action. Look at David Lynch's stuff.
Yes, and which is one of the things that I loved about that whole, like, little... staging area for Paprika, where she would go and the two people would be there. It kind of reminded me of...
The Radio Club.
Yeah, the Radio Club reminded me very much of the lodges, and they had the writer...
The short guy,
yeah,
big guy.
Which is, it's, their names is Kuga and Jinai. I'm pronouncing it wrong, but the main point is, that's the author and the director.
Yeah.
And I think of them kind of like the dwarf and the giant from the
Right, the whole... Everything in Paprika, you get a very rich dream logic and a dream semblance to it. Mm-hmm. A movie like Inception, you have a few set pieces that you can get away with doing dreams, like, you know, the hallway that's tumbling over.
Right.
But everything has a literalness to it that really kind of kills it for me after a while. The whole thing really feels more like it's done on the logic of a video game, where you have level one is this dream, level two is that
right,
dream.
Right, right.
And something here affects, and something in level one affects something that happens in level two. You really do not have that same type of surreal associative quality where, you know, if you're thinking about, if you're thinking about a dragon in one scene, a dragon can appear. You have, like, a little bit of that in the movie where, like, the train appears out of nowhere, but then, like, a character says, oh, you're doing this associative thing, stop it, and then he stops it.
Right, right.
So, like, there's not a whole lot that's very interesting on that level for me in Inception. Paprika has that, you know, Paprika knocks that out of the park.
Mm, for sure. Any other dream movies you want to compare it to? Because what do you think?
There's a little bit of Strange Days is really more of like a virtual reality movie.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not even sure if virtual reality is the right thing to describe it to there, like, because what they're doing there is they're recording, you know, what somebody is seeing and hearing.
Right,
and
they were recording that in Paprika too. In the beginning, they were reviewing the person's dreams. But
true, but they're recording what somebody is actually seeing and hearing in real life. I mean, what's interesting there, and I think Strange Days is a movie that's definitely worth reevaluation, especially in this modern age of kids being killed left and right by policemen.
Oh, yeah.
Because remember, that whole movie is basically a thinly sci-fi version of Rodney King.
Funny.
And it's all about, you know, what's funny is Strange Days, the VR mind consciousness recording equipment, is used at first by cops who are going to go undercover and, you know, get, you know, they're basically being used as, like, body cams to record their undercover missions.
Mm-hmm.
But it winds up being used by somebody by accident to record an act of police brutality. And I think that would be a really interesting concept to revisit in this age where people are talking about, you know, body cameras and people are talking about, like, surreptitiously recording stuff. I mean, Strange Days is a movie that is happening now on a regular basis whenever somebody takes out their cell phones.
Right. Yeah. So, they didn't have that technology back then like that easily in 1999. Well,
but what's also
they were taking place in 1999, but this was taking place in 95.
But what's also interesting about that movie is that is how they imagined the future was going to be. They probably didn't even, you know, a friend of mine once said that the only things in a sci-fi movie or story that don't change are the things that the people making it can't imagine ever could change.
Like what?
Like, look
at the Blade Runner stuff.
Well, how about this? In Blade Runner,
yeah,
they have robots in the future.
Yeah.
They have spaceships and flying stuff in the future.
Yeah.
They still have cathode ray TV screens everywhere.
Dun, 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 dun.
And you have that, you know, all the time. Now, granted, in TV, in movies, you kind of have to rely on stuff like that at the time just because, you know,
the technology
available at the time. But you have people who do other things. Like in Star Wars, they don't have cathode ray things. They have holograms. They have holograms. They have other things. But in terms of what you were saying before, like other movies that are doing like the dream stuff better.
Sure.
Paprika is probably the best. It's one of the best.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of other things that do it better than Paprika, better than Inception.
Okay.
The things that do it better than Inception, Dreamscape is one that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Not a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
Is Brainscan one?
I'm not sure. I didn't see Brainscan.
I've got to see Brainscan. Nightmare on Elm Street. That is one of the first ones that really makes use of that.
And I was talking about Dream Warriors. So Dream Warriors is one that it uses lucid dreaming.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that Dream Warriors is basically, it's taking the stuff that was already in Nightmare on Elm Street and giving you an even better version of it.
So what year was Nightmare on Elm Street, did we say?
84.
84, and
Dream Warriors was either 86 87, or 87. 87,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, those two movies, And Dream Warriors in particular, like you're saying, they really capture the essence of dreaming as like a sci-fi trope, as a sci-fi concept, and they do it really well.
Mm.
They do it such to the extent that it makes me a little sad whenever somebody does something, what does like a movie or a story that's patterned on dreams, and now they'll say, oh, just like Inception.
They should
be saying, just like Nightmare on Elm Street, or, just like Dream Wars.
Hey, we can take it back to Videodrome or Naked Lunch or something like that.
A little bit of Videodrome. I mean, like, not quite, because, again, they're using, like, other types of mediums and sci-fi stuff and technology there to make that work. But, yeah, I mean, there's other stuff you can check out. Like, I remember there's even, like, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a animated show back in, like, the late 80s, early 90s, like, something like the Midnight Kids, like, kids in this, like, suburban area who are all in each other's dreams, the Dream Zone.
No, never heard of that one.
It was a really interesting show. Is it
Japanese or American?
I think it's British.
Really?
And it was exported over here and given, like, American accents or something.
Funny.
It was done around the same time as, like, Don Coyote.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. I always thought it was Hanna-Barbera, but I'm not sure. But yeah, the way that Paprika treats dreams is very much in step with the way that, like, Nightmare on Elm Street treats dreams or Dreamscape treats dreams. They're using dreams both as an excuse to have fun with surrealism, something that Inception does not do at all.
Yeah, which is kind of weird, because it's dreams, you know?
Yeah, but they're also using it as a case to really talk about creative media, the way our own minds work.
That next level down, that thinking, that subliminal,
yeah.
like below the surface, there's all this stuff that seems nonsensical.
Yeah. And I think, and a lot of this is also tied into, like, the sexual imagery in this movie, in Paprika, that is there right from the beginning, but gets steadily and steadily more clear, more lucid, more profound.
Like, for example? Like when she's captured by the guy with the butterfly?
That is separate. Like, that whole scene is basically...
creepy!
That is basically, like, a Salvador Dali rape scene.
Yeah,
and
really
it's disturbing to see, you know, how that progresses. And it also underlines the alter ego aspect of this movie, where, she is torn apart from the inside, right from her groin, and on the inside of Paprika is the naked Dr. Chiba.
Right.
And it's a really disturbing scene for all sorts of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the fact that the movie doesn't shy away from that, but also does not really linger in on it for entirely prurient reasons.
Yeah, it's got, like, she's naked. She's laid bare, literally, because this is the real her.
Right. This is the real her. And it's
no
not,
costume.
You know, and it's not, like, shoving the camera right into her nethers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other things like this in the movie that happened before. Like, you know, think about this.
Mm-hmm.
When we first have the cop waking up from his dream and Paprika's showing him all this stuff.
Right.
Right after, like, she first introduces him to the DC Mini, we fade into them watching footage from his dream on a computer.
Mm-hmm.
They're in a hotel room and they're both wearing bathrobes.
Right.
There's an implicit subtext here going on of, like, Paprika not just as, like, a therapist, but almost Paprika as, like, a call girl.
Right, like yeah, and she's doing this out call.
Right, she's doing this out call. It's not 100% there, because if you look closely, there are two beds. Obviously, nothing has actually gone on between them.
Right.
But he's affected in a deep way that's almost like, you know,
that's
when
cool.
can I see you again?
Exactly, yeah, I love
and everybody,
that.
And, right, and everybody is sort of in love with her on that
yeah.
sense. Or, like, say,
she's
when...
She's a dream girl, literally.
Right, and say, like, later on, when she goes into the dream of, you know, her superior, and she has to save him from the parade.
Uh-huh.
It's a very sexualized moment where she...
And Shima. Shima's the dog.
Right, Shima. Where she, you know, sinks into his body and inflates him from the inside.
Right, right.
You know, she gives him, you know... I think everybody
she
who...
She blows him up.
Yeah, she gives him a blowjob.
Ba-dum-bum.
But, you know, that's another heavily... What's interesting there is it's a sexualized moment.
Mm-hmm.
but we're not seeing any actual sex act that we can, like, there's no sex act
right,
like that where somebody's
to...
being... Right, she right,
and she's like a little, she's like a little baby doll. She's
right,
like
that's,
a girl,
that's how
girl.
She starts.
She's like a little girl.
Right, right, that's how she starts. So that's I mean that's a scene that's really playing on a lot of existing fetish types from Japan.
Yeah, sure,
but,
and in America too.
Right, but it's not so, like it's not like we don't see her literally giving him a blowjob. We don't see her literally like straddling him and you know doing explicit sexual things.
She just crawls up on top of him and then goes
right,
inside of him.
Right, sinks inside of him. It's more physical, but at the same time more subtle, even than, say, we've just recently had, like, I think the 25th anniversary of Tony Kushner's play Angels in America.
Okay.
And when it was done for television on HBO by Mike Nichols, there are scenes where the prophet, Prior Walter, has, like, this sexual activity with the angel. And the way they portray it is very, like, you know, it has a lot of fire, it has a lot of, you know, inner, you know, but at the same time, you're not seeing literal sex between them. You see them stripped bare naked and fire from their groin connecting, but you don't see them actually having what you could call penetrative sex.
Right.
And that's interesting there because, you know, you're trying to approximate what is being described on stage as this, like, very strange sort of hermaphroditic experience.
Okay.
But even what's going on there in Angels in America is more literally sexual because you're having, like, the rocking of the hips and stuff
right,
like that.
Right,
you're having a sort of pantomime of sex. Here...
Then afterwards everyone wants to smoke a cigarette.
Right. Here, you don't have a pantomime of sex,
uh-huh.
but you have a... surreal image that is in many ways much more loaded in sexual terms. What you have is something that literally feels like something that you'd see in a dream.
Right, like he's actually getting turned on. He's like, oh, look
right,
at
right, he's
you.
Getting
turned.
He's
it.
Getting turned on, but at the same time inflated way past something that you'd have.
Yeah,
right,
like exactly.
You,
it took it, him to the point and past.
Right,
and then he explodes.
And,
he explodes.
Right,
get it?
And you were talking about like earlier on. You were talking about. A sexual imagery that's going on at the end as well.
Oh yeah, that whole thing with her growing up and then sucking him pretty the big bad over here.
Yeah.
And sucking all his energy.
Yeah.
And absorbing it.
Yeah.
And she's pretty much
and again
you know.
It's another scene that plays on the like youth fetish because you see her going from
yeah every time she sucks his energy
she grows up. Yeah,
the
I mean
experience.
Yeah. It's moments like that that give me, like, a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling because I think here...
Sure.
It's interesting how he's deconstructing that and how he's then... The end game of that, when she's done all that and beaten the guy, she basically becomes a goddess standing
yes.
in the middle of the city. But at the same time...
Proud in her nakedness.
Right, but at the same time, there is something, like, a little uncomfortable and
yeah.
weird.
I saw it in the theater and I felt, like, ugh, I feel creepy.
Yeah, right.
But you know what? Then that's just me.
I don't think it was just...
Oh, okay, thank God.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting to see how he's deconstructing this, and it's, again, one of those things that really tears you up inside. You would have loved to see where he would have gone from this, because...
The director?
Yeah, the director. Because even at this moment that is sort of, like, the first big break moment that he has, like, if he were Fellini,
mm-hmm.
this movie would have been his 8.5.
Mm-hmm.
This would have been the movie that, or this would have been like his 8.5, his Dolce Vita. This would have been the movie that introduced mainstream art house audiences to this director, even after he'd done a significant little body of work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's and even though this was like ostensibly the middle part of his career when he was just beginning to ramp up, even at that point, it's interesting to think he had already outpaced other directors like.
Mm-hmm.
Think of how many movies he's directed in his lifetime. He's done Perfect Blue, Millennium Actress,
Tokyo
Godfathers, Paranoia Agent, which is a whole series,
okay.
and this, Paprika. That's 5 major works.
Did he do anything after that? Or he died after that?
He died after that, but like, that's 5 major animated works, and several major manga works that he'd done besides that.
Pancreatic cancer, for those of you that haven't done your homework.
Yeah. But compare that, say, to Katsuhiro Otomo.
Okay.
Katsuhiro Otomo did some major manga work, Domu and Akira.
Sure.
Then he did a number of shorts and anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
Then he does Akira, the feature.
Yes.
The Big Daddy.
Yes.
Then he doesn't do anything for a very long time.
What can you do after that? That's like your magnum opus, dude.
Right, like he does a couple of live action features. I think he does like World Department Horror and Mushishi.
World Department Horror actually,
Satoshi Kon did a manga for that too.
Yeah, he did stuff.
Yeah, but after that, like it took him a very long time to do another, anime in the form of Steam Boy. But at the end of the day, his work output is oddly less than Satoshi Kon's.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Maybe Satoshi knew that, like that of a David Bowie at the end, when he knew he was dying, he went and he did that final push and did all this work. I mean, like, plays,
no,
this,
no, that. I don't think so, because, remember, he had spent a couple of years before he died working on another feature.
Uh-huh.
And people are trying to finish that now, and hopefully they will, but, that's the thing.
Okay.
Yeah, but there is a whole lot of this sexual stuff going on in the movie, and even when it's at its creepy, the fact that you're talking about dreams
and dreams are creepy like that,
right,
sexy like
right,
that.
Right, you have all this Freudian, Jungian imagery going on, and the fact that they stretch, I think, a little bit too far to invoke Oedipus.
Oh, come on, you think that was a little heavy-handed?
Yeah, but I mean, like, they go a little too far to put Oedipus in there, but at least they lay the foundation for it at a certain point.
Yeah.
So there is an Oedipal thing going on, like, the artwork that they have on display at certain points of the movie. Of the movie. This is, like I said, in addition to having these wide compositions and wide-angle stuff throughout the movie, what that does is show you every single detail on screen has to be paid attention to. This is a movie that rewards your attention rather than one that just takes it for granted.
Yeah, you know what? I remember that when they were talking, they were making a description about how this thing sort of works, the DC Mini thing works, and he's describing it, and he's in a car, right? And then you see these, and it's raining or something like that, and you see these, like, rain, like, on the windshield, like, coalescing, and I was just like, really? Seriously? You're doing that with animation? That is awesome right there.
Yeah, you have, like, a moment, like, it reminds me just a little bit of, like, the two, like, the drops of water that Malcolm uses in Jurassic Park.
Okay.
To demonstrate chaos theory.
Okay.
And what you're having is a little bit of a moment like that, but the fact that you're having that level of animation, frame by frame, being used to illustrate that small, tiny movement of the raindrops, it lets you know why, in other cases, he's, relying on still images or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You would never have a moment like that so minute and detailed in a Disney movie, because they're using that level of animation throughout the whole thing just for the characters, which is fine,
right.
But it's beautiful to have a moment like this.
Character-driven stuff.
It's beautiful to have a moment that isn't character-driven, but is nonetheless really beautiful on an environmental detail.
Right. And this is one of the things that I loved about this movie, because it was a lot about environment and also about nature and also about the nature of dreams.
Yeah.
And it's like we were talking about it, and it keeps on coming back to comparisons of Okira, because it's going to have that Otomo imprint in there thing. And we're talking about the large-scale devastation, which is indicative in such a big love of Japanese moviegoers, from Gojira to
Well, what's nice here is that, of course, because Satoshi Kon was like an apprentice of Katsuhiro Otomo,
uncredited,
because the two of them work so close on a lot of things, this isn't just a fan shout out. This is also a little bit of a personal shout out, especially because it's important to look at the relationship between the cop and the scientist, older guy, younger guy, mentorship going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of that he's recognizing from the work.
Right.
And like you said, you can also see like little bits of anime shout outs throughout, like the detective being similar to
the colonel for sure, and also to the Shima definitely being like that scientist,
yeah,
like, constantly always pouring over his facts and figures kind of thing.
Yeah. He also reminds me. I remember he also reminds me very much of the Ape Face. I can't remember his name exactly, but like the guy from Ghost in the Shell.
Okay, well, you know what? I haven't seen Ghost in the Shell yet. I'm looking forward to seeing that one.
We're going to have to cut that out because Ghost in the Shell is coming first.
Okay, fine.
Okay, but what he reminds me of is,
There's a pause there.
So right, what he reminds me, like, the scientist in this movie, he also reminds me of the director of Section 9 from Ghost in the Shell.
Ah.
And what's interesting there is that also, the similarity that he has there, and the similarity that you see in their working relationship between the different scientists, it sets up the possibility for this procedural element in the movie. You could very easily imagine, like, a TV show version of this.
Yeah? You really think so?
Yeah. In fact,
live,
you know,
action or?
In fact, you know what? I'm not going to keep that in because I'm going to use that myself someday.
Oh, okay. You're going to do a live action or animation?
I'm not going to say on the recording.
Oh, no, but I'm just asking you.
Right. But I mean, like, he definitely reminds me of the director of Section 9. So it gives you, like, you know, it shows you how much these things can interpolate and everything.
Mm.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, the fact that you have all these other things that relate to different anime and different things, like, even, like, the, you know, even, like, the amusement park that they go to, it's depending on very much the same idea and the same historical plot point that Spirited Away uses.
Sure.
The abandoned amusement park from, you know...
Please,
the,
that goes
the,
everywhere,
the,
all
right,
the way
from
to
the
Killing
bubble.
Joke right over here in
right,
America.
From the economic bubble.
Sure.
But it's really, you know, it's really sad to look at that and see all these things and see the place that Satoshi Kon was aware of for anime's history and the bigger place that there could have been for him in the future.
Mm.
You know, this is a guy who, you know, like I've said, was in many ways just starting out. This is a guy who, if he hadn't passed away when he did, he could have easily had another 20 years ahead to come up with new stuff. And if this is where he was, if this was him at his most mainstream, and this was him at his most mainstream,
right,
imagine what he could have done with greater resources later on. Imagine what he could have done with a bigger budget and more daring producers. It's just sad.
Well, I'm going to hope that he had assistants and stuff like that, because just like Otomo had mentored him,
yeah,
did he have any people that he mentored?
I'm not sure if he has, like, there's nobody that we know of to the same extent.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure that there are, but there's nobody that we know of in the same sense. But, like,
well, I hope they'll be stepping up, because I'm curious to see what these people will do, people that have lived around this and been around this. But you know what? People could now check these films out and be inspired by them.
Yeah, but I mean, one of the other things that kind of makes me sad is to think about, this is a guy who is taking animation in Japan and pushing it into a very adult territory.
Definitely.
In the wake of his hentai kind of way. In the wake of his passing,
yeah,
who is, like, the most famous new animation director? I would say it's probably Mamoru Hosada.
Okay.
He's a guy who did Summer Wars, who did Children.
Yeah.
Did Boy and the Beast. Those are all very good movies, but they also represent, I think, a little bit of a step backwards.
Yeah, taking it back to the kids again.
Right. Not quite taking it back to the kids, but taking it back to the teens, at least.
Uh-huh.
Like, Summer Wars is a great movie, and it has great, you know, designs by Sadamoto and everything.
And it's so to now, like, with all the people going crazy for Pokemon Go
right now.
It definitely is a call to
these things. Yeah, but it's also a movie that feels very much like it's for younger concerns, younger characters. Then you have a movie like Wolf Children, which is beautiful, which every anime and animation fan should go out and see. But Wolf Children is, again, a movie about childhood and growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It was sad to see the loss of a guy like Satoshi Kon, who was making a movie about adulthood and adult concerns, and doing that throughout his whole career as an animator, but never once forgetting to make it fun.
Right.
Like, one of the things that I think that sadly goes on in, like, American filmmaking and other filmmaking in general is that when you start making, quote-unquote, adult movies,
yeah,
they tend to get really, really fucking boring.
Yeah. Outside, can I have an example of this, please?
Outside of, like, genres, like, Woody Allen.
I knew it! I was saying, I'm not gonna say Woody Allen. I'm not gonna say... And you said it! You know, yeah. Back in the days, you look at Bananas or even What's Up, Tiger Lily or things like this that are having, like, wacky kind of fun, and all of a sudden you become this... When you get the Oscars and things like that, you become this adult and it gets kind of like, oh, let's do this.
I mean, like, even if you look at, like, Annie Hall, for a movie that's about, like, adult concerns, it's basically a sketch comedy movie.
Yeah, and even got some animation in there, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's a movie that's having fun with itself. And
yeah, literally.
Granted, when you look at a lot of his movies later on, some of them can get a little creepy. Like, in Annie Hall, you have the scene of, like, people, like, the kids talking about what they're going to be when they grow up, and the little girl says, I'm into leather.
Right.
There's some really creepy stuff going on with Woody Allen. But as he went on in his career, the more his adult sensibilities became really just boring. And there's not... I mean, like, there are some movies of his that I think are very good, but at the same time,
right,
so many of his movies...
Mighty Aphrodite, come on. Those things, they've got the Oscars there.
But so many of his movies, I think, are also... They just kind of blend together in my head. Like, there's all of the movies...
Come on, the time travel one?
All of the movies of his 80s period... are all basically just...
Oh, the Hannah and his sisters
right there.
Nice
it's
spot.
All right. Hannah and her sisters, they all basically look and feel the same to me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I'm talking about movies that have completely different plots sometimes, like Crimes and Misdemeanors or Husbands and Wives. I can't really feel a big difference between them in the same way that I can between, you know...
Well, he knows
The
what
Shining
works.
And
knows
The
what
Clockwork
works for
Orange.
Him. He knows what works for
and
him.
And, like, now you're, like, you know, he's just finished, I guess his European period.
Uh-huh.
And now I guess he's just, like, what, in his, trying to recover his career from being accused of child molestation period.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, that's what we have in terms of, you know, adult filmmaking. And that's the sort of thing that people are always, like, whining about how it's gone forever. And really, that's just what you have in, you know, indie filmmaking nowadays. The Miramax filmmaking.
Yeah, you call it the indie filmmaking now?
The institutional indie filmmaking. Uh-huh. The Miramax.
The real true indie films can't get that noticeability, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, and that's one of the things that I really miss from Satoshi Kon, even outside of animation, because you look at his other movies, like, you look at a movie like, you know, just look at the breadth of subject matters that he covered. He goes from, you know, J-pop idols and... paparazzi, stalker, tabloid culture in Perfect Blue.
Yeah.
Then the next movie he does is all about a silent film star looking back on her life and Millennium Actress.
Uh-huh.
Then you have, you know, three homeless people and, like, a... Yeah, you're right. You have a homelessness. You have, like, you know, the drag queen.
Right. Sexuality, like, LGBTQ kind of stuff going on there.
And here you have, you know... dreams coming alive and everything.
He never did
the same subject twice all the way, and it would have been really great to see the stuff that he came up with in the years since.
Mm.
You know, where was he going to go? What was he going to do? What statements was he going to make? It would have been great to see him do something in live action, too, but he was one of the premier animators.
Mm.
So the fact that we lost him makes a movie like Paprika even more valuable, because it's one of those few movies that I would say there are definitely movies I like better than Paprika. There are definitely anime movies that I like better than Paprika. But on many, like, this is one of those movies that I think hits almost every note that it wants to perfectly.
Right.
And the fact that we've lost somebody who is capable of doing that is really sad. You know,
would say that this is his best film.
I think it... very possibly is his best film, but the thing that's really sad about it is that if that was his best film now, he could have done stuff that was even better later on. Like, you know, like I said with, you know, Fellini, mm-hmm. if this was his 8.5, we never got to see his Satyricon. So...
But then, you know, like I said, pancreatic cancer it ain't no joke. It just takes people right out.
Yeah, so I guess that's all we have to say about Paprika, and... yeah. What Was Lost. And that's it for Paprika, number 76 on the countdown. Next time I'll be joined by Lost in the Movies writer Joel Bacco, where we will discuss the greatest anime of all time. Until then, this is Bob Clark of Cinema Hill, reminding you, all democracy is a popularity contest. Just don't expect any fan service.